I'm Gina Kaufman, and let's turn now to crime novelist Joel Goldman, whose grisly books mine Kansas City's seedy underbelly for material. Good morning, Joel.
Good morning, Gina.
So I've begun reading your work, starting with Stone Cold. It's pretty shocking and quite literally very close to home, like seriously way too close to home.
Well, I'll let you fill in why it's so close to home. But the opening of that book is shocking because it's intended to set up the dilemma that public defender Alex Stone really faces. She is defending somebody accused of a horrific murder. She faces one of the two nightmares for criminal defense lawyers. Then there are two. One is that you help a guilty person go free, and the other is that you're not able to prevent an innocent person from being convicted. So that's the setup, and it's this book, Stone Cold, is about the first nightmare, that the guilty person goes free. And we've got to understand from the beginning that this is a bad guy.
Well, we'll get back to the plot of that novel and probably a couple of others, but tell us a little bit about your background. You used to be a trial lawyer. What kinds of cases did you try, and who were your clients by and large?
I was a trial lawyer for 28 years. My practice was all over the country, mostly representing businesses in product liability, tort cases, and in business disputes.
You weren't really dealing with the kinds of cases that are peppered throughout your novels?
No, I didn't do criminal defense work.
So how did you become really knowledgeable in this kind of case? And did you learn about that sort of stuff in law school, or do you have friends who worked in that arena, or just from reading the newspaper?
The most important thing that a novelist needs to do is, regardless of genre, is pay attention to the world around. And you'd be surprised at how much you absorb just from that. I had 28 years of experience in the courtroom and a lot of familiarity with the judicial system as a result of that. But there were also a lot of people who helped me, people who I consulted with from law enforcement. Carrie Allen is one of the top public defenders in Kansas City, previously with the on the state side. Now she's moved over to the federal side, and she was a tremendous resource for me, very helpful in understanding how the public defender system worked. So I do my research.
Well, as a trial lawyer, you did that for, you said, 28 years?
Yes.
So I understand that you developed a medical condition that prevented you from continuing to practice as a trial lawyer. Do you mind my asking what the condition was?
No, not at all. 10 years ago, I developed a movement disorder called tics. That's T-I-C-S, not the kind that are out in the woods. It's similar to Tourette's. It is unknown cause, unknown cure. The good news is it's not life-threatening or life-shortening, but it is life-annoying. My neurologist at Mayo said that it was not compatible with continuing to practice law. It'll cause me to shake, spasm, stutter, different things like that. The more I do, the more of that I experience, so I have to manage it by a balanced lifestyle in terms of how I use my time. And fortunately, it's not very taxing to kill people.
Elaborate on that.
It's not very taxing to write about killing people, write crime novels. So I'm very fortunate that I'm able to pursue what is a terrific passion of mine, which is writing.
Yeah, it's funny that you should say it's not taxing to kill people. I had a moment where I was thinking of asking you what made you turn to crime. But that is really the question. You have this 28-year-long career as a lawyer. You find out that you can't continue practicing that career. I could imagine myself in a situation like that feeling fairly lost and maybe in a way that would deprive me of the imagination necessary to come up with an alternative. But yet you came up with this idea of writing crime novels. How did you come up with that idea?
Well, actually, the sequence is a little backwards there, because 22 years ago next month, I was in my office at my law firm, and one of my good friends came in to talk to me. And what people may not realize is that all lawyers don't get along with one another.
I'm shocked.
Well, I know, but now I've lifted the veil. and anyway, my partner, my friend, poured his heart out to me about another partner who was making his life miserable. And you know, when somebody does that, when they just rip themselves open for you with a terrible problem, they get to the point where they stop and then they look at you with the expression that says, how are you going to solve my problem? So that's what he did. And my immediate response was, let's just write a murder mystery. We'll kill the SOB off in the first chapter and spend the rest of the book figuring out who did it. And that's literally the spark. And I wrote that book, which became my first book, Motion to Kill. That was started back in 1992. It was released, finally published in 2002, which made me a 10-year overnight success. And then in 2006, when I had to leave my law practice, I already had a writing career. So that's the first part of the answer. But to answer what you the other part, which is sort of the meatier part of it, is how do you make that transition?
Yeah.
That's a difficult thing to do because so many of us define ourselves by what we do. We validate ourselves by what we do. And as a lawyer, I was in the business of helping people solve their problems. And as a crime novelist, I'm really in the business, not really about killing people. That's just a perk. But
to be fair, you're creating them too.
Yes, that's the point. The great thing about crime fiction is it's a wonderful opportunity to explore the human condition. What happens when things go wrong, and especially when you think no one's looking? How do people respond to things? For example, that violent opening in Stone Cold. The violence is off screen.
It is.
It's reported after the fact. I'm much more interested in the effect of the violence on the characters and the story than I am in depicting the violence itself, even though there are terrific writers out there and who focus more on the moment in which the violence occurs. And there's a tremendous attraction to that. But for me, I'm more interested in how that impacts the characters in this story.
And the characters, that includes not only the victims and perpetrators of crimes, but also the characters in the courtroom, the lawyers, the judges,
sure,
the police officers, the CSI people who come to the crime scenes. One of the things about the lawyer character, the public defender in Stone Cold, that's kind of interesting is that you really let the reader inside her mind during the trial. And she does these things that I wouldn't have thought about lawyers doing, though it makes sense. Like she sometimes raises objections that she knows will be overruled just because she can see that the prosecutor and his witness are hitting their stride and she wants to break the momentum. Do lawyers in the courtroom really think about things like pacing and dialogue?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Trial lawyers are storytellers. The courtroom is the place where that story is told. And I think you have a background in storytelling.
I like to think so.
But it's a different kind of storytelling than is done in a novel. But still, as if you're trying a case, you have to figure out how you're going to tell that story. And pacing and character development are every bit as important in the courtroom as they are in a novel. But the tools that you use are obviously different. So, yes, it's not at all unusual for a lawyer to make an objection during the examination of a witness by the opposing lawyer just to try to throw the lawyer or the witness off their pace or to draw the jury's attention to something that the lawyer wants them to focus on instead. And that's just one of the many tricks of the trade.
So in terms of the tricks of the lawyer trade, what did you learn from being a lawyer that you apply to your writing that you think maybe some writers just don't have this skill because they didn't have your courtroom training?
I'm thinking about my friend Michael Connelly, who writes a legal thriller series, The Lincoln Lawyer. And Michael captures the courtroom completely. even though he's a journalist by training and never went to law school. So I don't know that you have to be a lawyer or a trial lawyer in order to do that. But from my perspective, I think it did give me an advantage because that sense, that feel of the courtroom, which you get from being in the courtroom, that understanding of the arena nature of it, the combative nature of it, and how you have to be on every second that you're in the courtroom. Even if you're just sitting there listening, you have to be completely on. That's something that I tried to convey.
Well, we'll be back to this conversation with Joel Goldman after a break. You're listening to Central Standard, and when we get back, we'll be talking to Joel about how Kansas City performs as both a setting and really a character in his crime novels. That's after the break. You're listening to Central Standard. Good morning and welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman talking with Joel Goldman, who's a Kansas City writer. He writes crime novels set here in Kansas City, and he brings a whole career as a trial attorney to that project. If you have questions for Joel Goldman, you can call us at 816-235-2888, and we'll be continuing this conversation. We were just discussing his novel Stone Cold. Joel, one of the things in that book that really also fascinated me is the jargon. There's this reference to someone or an event during a trial called the money, for example. Can you explain that concept and how you originally learned about it?
I'd like to tell you they taught that in law school, but I came up with it for this book. It just came to me in one of those creative epiphanies. But the concept, I think, is any trial lawyer would immediately recognize. And the money, as it's used in this context, is what makes or breaks the case. Is it a piece of evidence? Is it the testimony of a particular witness? And in the trial that is going on when Stone Cold opens, the money is a witness who is going to implicate the defendant beyond any reasonable doubt as guilty. So that's the money. And what Alex Stone says to her client, Dwayne Reed, before the trial is basically, you need to tell me who the money is. What's the money? And like a lot of criminal defendants and civil clients, they don't always tell the lawyer everything. So there's a great moment in that book when Dwayne Reed recognizes this witness and says, he's the money. And Alex says, yes, he's the money.
Well, so in this one book, there are a number of Kansas City settings that come up. One is Truman Medical Center. Another is the Kansas City police headquarters. There's the courthouse, which is, you describe in a very recognizable kind of way, just the architecture of that space. And then, of course, Kansas City's East Side gets some treatment in that book. And I wonder, especially with the discussions of Kansas City's East Side, if you experience any qualms about maybe romanticizing violence or risking the sensationalism of what goes on in a certain area of our city.
I think every writer has to decide how they're going to address the question of romanticizing or sensationalizing evil or bad things. The east side of Kansas City is not an evil place. It is not a bad place. It happens to be a place with a high crime rate and a high poverty rate, and those are facts. And to romanticize that would be to make it somehow attractive, seductive, desirable. And I don't think the books do that. There's always an attraction to the dark side. That's the human side. But the attraction to the dark place, the difficult place, the challenging place, I don't think we romanticize that. But we do try to create a sense of place where place is also a character. And so that's what I try to do with whatever part of the city that I write about. I'm a fourth generation Kansas Cityan. I love Kansas City. And by that, I mean, you know, the five county metroplex, the whole package. We have such a diverse, rich, fascinating history. Just about everything has happened at one time or another in one part of Kansas City or another. So to understand a character like Duane Reade, you have to understand where he came from. And where he came from is not just streets and sidewalks and houses. It is a place that has its own pulse, its own heart, it's a living organism. And that's the East Side. And it does produce some really harsh outcomes.
What kind of research did you do to develop that character of Kansas City's East Side?
I've read about it. I've been there. My dad had a wholesale plumbing and heating supply business where he had, when I was a kid in the late 50s and early 60s, he had a warehouse at 39th and Wabash. My grandparents lived near Paseo High School. I won't say that I didn't live there, but I have been there. I have spent a lot of time there. I've read a lot about it. So I feel like I have a sense of it. I don't want to overstate that and say that I know what it's like to live under those circumstances. I clearly don't.
You're bringing some imagination to this.
Yes. And it'd be presumptuous of me to say that I can tell what a character like Duane Reade's life was really like, but I can imagine it. And that's what I'm able to do. But I bring to that my own experience as a lifelong resident.
What are some of the other locations that you have sort of delved into in your books, in your settings?
The Northeast, it's a great, great part of the city along Independence Avenue. It was the first suburb. It was the first suburb. There were wonderful mansions that the lumber magnates and the shipping magnates that, you know, they built that area up, and it has gone through a transition it's sort of like thinking about the Northeast. You think about excavating in real time, looking back at the layers of the city's history as represented there, and it's now become a melting pot of immigrants from all over the world. So it's a fascinating area to me to write about. That's just one example.
And what about you? You have some work set in Quindaro.
Yes, that's my book, Shakedown, which features an FBI agent, Jack Davis. By the way, I gave Jack my movement disorder. As an aside, I did that because I wanted to use writing those books as a way of processing the changes in my life. I wanted to process that through Jack's eyes. But Kansas City, Kansas is also an area that's always interested me. When I first started practicing law, I was with a firm called Schneider, Schamburg & May, and we had an office at 7th and Huron, downtown Kansas City, Kansas. When I was growing up, I had a great aunt and uncle who had a hamburger joint at 38th and State called Blenders, where I would eat lunch with my brother and grandfather on Saturdays. So I also had a feel for Kansas City, Kansas. And that Quindaro area has some similarities to the East Side of Kansas City, Missouri. It's a high crime area, but it's also an area that people thrive in. So I wanted to set part of Shakedown there, but it's part of Shakedown's also set in Strawberry Hill, which is another fascinating neighborhood in Kansas City, Kansas, with a lot of Croatian influences. So it's just an opportunity to take different parts of the city and treat them as characters and bring them alive.
When you talk about Kansas City being a character, or maybe each individual neighborhood being a character, what are some of the traits of these characters? Can you get into, like, their personalities? Let's start, for example, with Strawberry Hill. You were just talking about that. Like, if you were describing Strawberry Hill as a character, what would you say?
Lots of heart. Okay. A real respect for tradition. a real sense of knowing who they are and having a lot of pride in that. So that's a strong that's a strong character.
When you think about characters, something that I always think about with characters is that what they want and what they need. So with, let's say, the Northeast, that neighborhood you were just talking about, what are the Northeast's wants and needs from your perspective as a novelist?
Well, it depends on the time period. It depends on when that's happening. But let's take today. Let's take the environment. Let's take the Northeast that appears in my third Jack Davis book titled No Way Out. The Northeast needs a break. Okay, the Northeast is battered. It's still a proud place. I mean, there are homes that are in the National Historical Register, and there are gangbangers pressing the area. There's drug traffic. There's a tremendous park system there. There's a lot of beauty there. So Northeast is struggling. There are real pockets of strength, and there are real pockets that are really trying to find their way. And there's a lot of tension there.
And there are also real pockets of gentrification.
Yes. Yes, there are definitely pockets of gentrification, and that creates a little bit of tension because the wants and needs of those who are participating in the gentrification of that area are in conflict often with those who are just trying to make it day to day.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Central Standard on KCUR 89.3 FM, streaming live on kcur.org. I'm Gina Kaufman talking with Joel Goldman, who's written about a dozen crime novels set in Kansas City. And if you have a question for Joel or a suggestion of a Kansas City location that would make a great setting for his next crime novel, call us at 816-235-2888. We've got a call from Gregor in Brookside. Hi, Gregor.
Yeah, good morning. I was very interested in what you said a few minutes ago about how you liked how you found the effects of crime and the effects, or rather, not so much the crime itself, but what happens after and the effect and the cyclical, I assumed you were speaking of. And my question is really it's two parts, or it's couched in a wonder if you have a solution. What do you feel is the seed of all evil, as far as, would you say it's neglect? Would you say it's abuse, sexual abuse? Would you say it's, is it just drugs? Is it, you know, violence? Is what do you, coming across all these victims in your, that you've no doubt seen in your life, what is there a common cause? And the $64,000 question is, what is there an answer?
Well, it sounds like, first of all, let's clarify, Joel, have you witnessed the kind of violence you write about?
No, I haven't. But the caller asks a terrific question. He asks two terrific questions, and I'm not going to dodge it, but we don't have 2 or 3 weeks to talk about it. There isn't a simple, straightforward answer to it.
To the question of the root of evil.
To the root of evil. To go back to your comment about contrasting wants and needs, it'd be overly simplistic to say when those wants and needs are in conflict with the wants and needs of others. You have everything from people, crimes of opportunity, people who you would think would never commit a crime, and they end up down a slippery slope and ask themselves, how in the world did I get here? So there are so many potential causes of crime. But one of the interesting undercurrents of that is whether is there such a thing as just evil? Are there people who, for whatever reason, are just irredeemably evil? And I think there are. As to the solution for all of these causes of crime, you got me.
Well, do you think evil is the cause of crime, or do you think that there are external influences or states of mind in a moment that wouldn't be sort of an all-pervasive evil that would be about that person at that moment?
I think all of the above. I think none of us know how we will respond under certain circumstances that we can't even contemplate. How far? One of the questions that comes up in Stone Cold is, how far will you go? How far will Alex Stone go?
And she's the public defender.
And she's the public defender to protect herself and the woman she loves. Those are tough questions. You can talk about them in the abstract. But when you're in that moment and you have to decide, we don't always meet the test. We often fall short, and that can happen as the result of a terrible upbringing. It can happen as the result of too much privilege. It can happen as a result of you're just wired bad.
Well, let's talk about crime fiction more generally, because you have projects both in writing crime fiction and in republishing some out-of-print classics. And I wonder what you think is the role of crime fiction in the bigger picture in our society.
I think crime fiction serves a couple of different roles. I'm going to set aside the entertainment part of it, because we all agree that there's plenty of entertainment in this kind of fiction.
The suspense, that kind of thing.
The suspense and the figuring out the puzzle, tremendously entertaining. But I think there's more at work here, and I alluded to one of those issues earlier, and that is the opportunity to explore the human condition and how we relate to these things. But I can give you a great example of another one. Our company, Brash Books, which is
– and when you say our –
my partner Lee Goldberg and I, who's an author, crime novelist in Kansas City – or in Los Angeles, rather, currently co-authoring a series with Janet Ivanovich. One of the reasons that we created Brash Books is we wanted to bring back some award-winning, critically acclaimed novels, but novels that were also important within our genre. And, for example, one of our authors, Barbara Neely, wrote a book, a series of books about an African-American domestic housekeeper, a woman named Blanche White. So let's stop right there. A black woman whose name is Blanche White.
Okay. And Blanche means white.
Exactly. So now we have white. Okay, this female character. And Barbara Neely is African American. And Barbara told me she didn't set out to write a murder mystery. She set out to write a novel about race, gender, and class. And she created this character to give a perspective that you don't really see. Hadn't seen to that point in crime fiction, a minority woman sleuth think of it as a Southern fried version of Downton Abbey.
Okay.
And so Barbara created this character and does a wonderful job of exploring issues of race, gender, and class. And nobody had done that in American contemporary crime fiction. No woman writer at that point, no African-American woman.
Are we talking about?
Pardon me?
When are we talking about?
These books were in the 90s, early 90s. So she created a unique character to give a voice and a perspective that hadn't been represented. And as a result of that, she inspired other minority crime fiction writers, female crime fiction writers, gave them a perspective on being able to create these kinds of characters and be commercially successful with them.
What inspired you to take on this project of republishing these out-of-print classics? Why did you feel like they needed either a new audience or a bigger audience?
Well, first of all, they're great books. They're terrific books. And in the era before the Kindle and before Amazon and before self-publishing became a legitimate publishing business model, so many terrific books like these because they didn't break out, because they didn't become bestsellers, their publishers moved on and dropped the authors. And there was really no alternative for the authors. And Lee and I have had great success self-publishing our previous books, called our backlists. And we got to thinking about it. Actually, last September, we were at a convention for mystery writers and fans. And we realized how successful we had been over several years, selling over 750,000 copies of our backlists. And we thought, why can't we apply the lessons we've learned and do the same thing with these terrific books? And so that's what we're doing. That was the inspiration.
Well, can we get back to Kansas City? Because, of course, our listeners are here, and I know that you probably have a pretty big audience of readers in Kansas City, being that you're from here and the books are set here. What do you hear from people who are either familiar with the neighborhoods that you're talking about or just have a lot at stake when they read these books? What do you hear back from them?
They love seeing their city represented in my books.
Even in scenes, I mean, you don't depict the violence itself, but even in the aftermath of something horrific having happened?
Yes, they do, because they're used to seeing crime novels in New York, Chicago, Los Angeles, Miami. Kansas City becomes too much of a flyover country in crime fiction, and they love saying, oh, I recognize that place, or I know, I lived over there. I hear that all the time, and it gives me a lot of satisfaction.
Well, speaking of I lived over there, we've got a call from Jim in Pleasant Hill. Hi, Jim.
Good morning. How are you?
Good.
You know, I wanted to give just a little bit different perspective on Kansas City's Northeast. I was born in 1941, and we moved there during the war. And so that's where I grew up, actually, until I left to go to the Navy in 1959. And it was really like living in a small town, sitting in the urban area. We would we'd leave in the morning, even when we were all kids. We'd be gone all day, you know, going on Cliff Drive, go up to Scarlet Point, we'd go to the museum.
Okay, Jim, I hate to do this, but the sound on that call wasn't so great, so we're going to go ahead and just discuss what he threw out just in that portion of his call. He mentioned that he grew up in the Northeast and during World War II, it sounded like, maybe, and that it was like living in a small town, and he mentioned
right.
Cliff Drive. And
yeah, he's right. That was a glory period for that part of town, and that's part of the transition that a lot of different parts of the city have gone through. I grew up at 79th and Campbell between Holmes and Troost, and I remember as a young kid getting on the bus with my brother and the other kids on the block and going downtown to the movies. And we would no more allow our kids to do that today than you could possibly think about. It was a different time, and it's great to be able to write about all the different times in the history of the city.
As a writer, and in fact as a lawyer, you really need to employ a high level of observation as you move through the city. And you mentioned these bus rides. Do you remember, have you used the details that you sort of stored away at that time of your life? Do they come back in your novels?
Oh, sure. In fact, in No Way Out, Jack Davis takes a bus ride because he doesn't drive very much because of his movement disorder. So he uses the city's buses to get around. And so he takes that he takes that ride through the Northeast where he reflects on all those changes.
And Jack Davis, he's the character who in some ways, at least in terms of his physical condition, is based on you. How has it been for you to work through your medical struggles through this character?
It's been a great experience, and it was cathartic to me, and helped me be more comfortable with my new world. And I think it's helpful for others to learn about this sort of obscure condition in that way.
And what's next for Jack Davis?
Well, I'm not sure. And, at the end of No Way Out, he's getting on a plane at KCI. And we think he's going to see the woman he's in love with, and we don't know if he got on the plane or got off.
Well, we'll have to keep reading to find out. I want to thank our guest, Joel Goldman, who writes crime novels set in Kansas City. He's also the founder of Brash Books. Joel, thank you so much for sharing your time with us this morning.
Thank you, Gina. Great being here.
To listen back to today's show or any previous conversations on Central Standard, go to kcur.org/centralstandard. You can also stay current on Central Standard News by following us on Twitter. Our handle is @KCURCST. Our show is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross. Tomorrow, hear the story of a woman who changed lives by suing the city over its public housing. We'll look back on a 37-year career in legal aid with Julie Levin. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned for Up to Date next.
You've been listening to Central Standard on KCUR-FM, KCUR-HD1, Kansas City Public Media. Good morning, I'm Linda Scher. Coming up today on The World, we get the latest from the city of Jos, Nigeria, the site of two deadly explosions there. Also, we'll find out what foreign countries spend the most money on lobbying in Washington. Those stories and more coming up on The World today at 2. Central Standard is made possible in part by Dr. Nancy Newhouse reminding you that a periodontist is a dental specialist with at least 3 years of specialty training who places implants, saves teeth, and manages long-term dental health. Details are online at newhouseperio.com. And Hendrick Lexus Kansas City and Hendrick Lexus North presenting the It's Your Turn Certified Pre-Owned Sales event going on now.